Yeah, it's a pretty grueling sport, swimming. And then I probably got put off it because you couldn't talk much through it. You know, your face is often in water. So hence the reason I quite like backstroke, because at least you could look up at the birds flying overhead or clouds in the sky or, you know.
Sure, hear the sounds.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series about some of the remarkable women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. The WA Women's Hall of Fame was created in 2011 to celebrate 100 years since the first International Women's Day staged in Germany in March 1911. In the century since that controversial day, girls and women have faced challenges to be recognised as equal citizens across the globe. The importance of identifying role models and sharing the history of women, sharing her story, remains as important as ever in 2021. I'm Taylor Strano. I hope you'll stay with me as we shine a light on the lives and careers of women who've demolished barriers, built incredible lives, and share a legacy of possibility for the girls and young women who follow in their footsteps. Through Herstory, we'll meet some inspirational characters, women in law, in science, in politics, and women in sport. Like today, our first guest to share her story is Jan Cooper.
Jan Cooper, AFLW Wellbeing Manager of the West Coast Eagles.
A wellness manager? I don't imagine that was always a position in the AFL.
No, it wasn't.
When did that start?
It probably started the first season of the Eagles. So we had the academy, and already there was a sense that there was going to be a need for off-the-grass support that we knew that there was going to be, but we didn't actually realise to what extent. So we then had myself, three volunteers, of which we've retained two of those. One's gone to Victoria, otherwise she still would be involved. And a player development manager, which was basically what my role was at the beginning. But I felt that if I'm only going to be part-time, then I needed to do something commensurate with part-time, which is the wellbeing role.
Is that something that happens in the men's league as well, or is that something that
we've established? We've got three fellows in the men's team, so they've got 45 athletes to deal with, and we've got 30, and we've got two of us, so 1.6, one full-time, 0.6 me, and then the two volunteers.
Wow.
And we triage out to professionals when we're required.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And so that includes things like, you know, making sure everyone's mental health is all right.
Yeah, that's our priority.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think maybe sometimes people forget when professional athletes or people that we're used to seeing on our TVs like are actually just human beings as well.
Yeah. And it's, and you saying that, Taylor, it's more the human being part that we're dealing with. So we have three little mantras: mind, body, craft. And the mind is more for how they are off the field. There's very few of them do sports performance psychology or anything like that. We do a little bit of imagery with some of them, but the majority, it's just getting the mindfulness right, their resilience, so they can actually thrive.
But you can't perform on field if you're not good off field, hey?
No. And what I've found with young women, and I'm thinking that it's more the social media era that they have been brought up in,
sure,
is that so many of them second guess themselves and don't have a rich self-belief. But when you start asking them questions, they actually have the answers to their issues or problems or concerns. They just don't have the bravery or the self-belief to actually follow through. Basically, I often think of myself as a big set of ears.
Excellent. I was just looking at your ears, like, no, they're pretty average size.
Oh, I know, they're tiny, really. That's why I've got a small head. Yeah, that's what I see myself as more.
I love that. So wholesome. And a part of sport that we maybe don't actually talk about that much.
No.
We're going to talk more about it later. I want to start way back at the beginning, though. You've already told me a little bit about all of the sports that you've been involved in. Do you have, like, an earliest memory or first sports memory, either for yourself or seeing sports?
I do. And when you posed that question in the list, I went, oh, they're not very positive.
That's okay.
Which is so bizarre. I was always a very physically active girl because our whole family was. And my first sport experiences, which I took the question as being formal, was going to the PCYC at Boulder, where we lived at the time, and learning gymnastics. And I was crap at it. So I didn't last very long. because I wasn't flexible and none of my mates were doing it. So, you know, you need to go to sport first and foremost because you've got friends there, and I didn't have anyone there. But it was all good intentions from mum and dad. And then the second experience was then we shifted back to Perth, and I just remembered being yelled at by a primary school teacher who was coaching the inter-school softball team. And again, I'd never, none of our family played softball, so it was quite a new sport. But I thought, oh, this looks like quite good fun. And she yelled at me because I hadn't sort of really chased with some competitive drive to get a catch in the outfield. And it didn't dawn on me, you know, as a, like an 11-year-old, that that might be something that you could do.
Yeah.
So even though it was kind of a bit of a negative thing, or I took it as a negative, that was my response at the time, but actually I started to, it resonated with me because then I realised I had got white line fever, and thanks very much to that teacher for pointing that out to me. So, so then I became more competitive, and then I wanted to be good at what I was doing, not just run around. So sure. Everything I did, I just remembered going, right, how can I be better at this? So, yeah, a bit tragic. So, yeah, then the sports, I took up swimming originally, which was a blessing because I have got a bit of a gimpy foot from birth, a congenital issue. So anything weight-bearing was always going to be revolting, and basically I did all weight-bearing sports really quite well. But I wasn't a bad swimmer, and I used swimming to recover and just for fitness now that I'm a bit older. So I'm really pleased that mum and dad paid for swimming and sure. put me on that path. I did break a few records at my high school at the time.
What kind of records are we talking?
Oh, backstroke, probably the 50 and 100 if I recall. And actually, like I wasn't a butterfly as...
That most
lace,
elegant
really.
Of the swims.
Yeah, and I remember one of my teachers at high school, just to have somebody swim in the inter-school, said, go on, I'll give you a chalk wedge if you go in the 50-metre butterfly. And I thought, yeah, chalk wedge sounds good, I'll do that. And I think I ended up getting in the first three places, so... But I wasn't a butterfly.
Well, you really wanted the chalk wedge.
Correct. And he knew that, obviously. Because that was quite a treat back in the day to get a chalk wedge.
I don't know if that's white line fever, then I think you were just driven by treats.
Yeah, maybe.
That's okay.
But I wasn't deprived of treats living in the family either, so it was slight. Anyway, so there's some of my daggy memories.
That's great. With that then, what kind of sport was on TV at the time? Is that something your family did?
No, I'm elderly, Taylor. There wasn't, and especially women's sport, there was nothing. Yeah. It was black and white TV at the beginning. And then when I was old enough to watch it, well, women didn't get on TV.
Mm.
I remember maybe some newsreels watching, you know, Dawn Fraser or something like that at the Olympics, but there was nothing. And as I grew older and became more aware of our place in the world, us being females, particularly in sport, I realised that the media was terrible. Their depiction was, here's an example that happened frequently, if you did get into mainstream media, netball used to be a winter sport, and so in the middle of winter they'd have netballers in a photo, in a bikini, on the beach, holding a netball, like that sexual connotation.
Yeah.
So, and even as I started to get a little older, like through uni, and then I thought, oh, really? Like, I'm thinking we're athletes first and foremost, and we're passionate about what we do or we love what we do. Why are we always depicted sexually, if at all? And then, of course, finally the tables turned, thank goodness.
I'm really interested because you've just mentioned there weren't many women, if at all, on TV, and if they were, they weren't depicted in a professional athlete sort of manner. So if they weren't on the TV and you were maybe being yelled at by your primary school softball teacher, where did your love of sport come from?
The family, because we're a physically active family. So Dad's always been involved in football. You know, my whole life, there's never not been a football in the household. And Mum, whilst always taking a quieter berth in the family, I remember Dad worked for the Commonwealth Bank when we were in Boulder. And so I would have been maybe five or six. And Mum went in the ladies' foot race at the race course, which was like a 100-metre sprint. And she was winning, I remember, at this picnic event and thinking, oh, my God, my mum runs so fast. How wonderful. I hope I get that skill. which I did to a certain extent, barring the gimpy foot, and she fell over, winning by a mile, fell over and just got up and off she went again, and she didn't win the race. But I remember thinking in that moment, as a 6 or whatever year old I was, going, my mum's friggin' fast, and she got up and finished even though she lost her glasses, you know, because she always wore glasses and stuff, and she just got up and went going, and I went, that's what I'm going to be like. So thanks, Mum, for doing that. And then I just think it's in the DNA.
It helps us as well. You mentioned like your parents took you to gymnastics, and while you maybe weren't going to be Simone Biles, you definitely it started for you though.
Well, and they were always supportive. Anything my brothers and I did, they would take us everywhere. And, you know, and back in the day, yes, we could walk to some of the places, and we had to because there was only one car and, you know, people going everywhere. Brother older and a brother younger, so they were in different age groups of, you know, the same sport. So always encouraged by Mum and Dad. And, you know, then I said, oh, do you reckon I could do swimming as a sport? And I'm thinking, I don't remember there being a light bulb moment, but I'm thinking, I've already said to you that, you know, maybe Dawn Fraser was on TV, and it's thinking, oh, I could do that. I knew I loved the water already because I love being at the beach and stuff like that. Yeah, it's a pretty grueling sport, swimming. And then I probably got put off it because you couldn't talk much through it. You know, your face is often in water. So hence the reason I quite like backstroke, because at least you could look up at the birds flying overhead or clouds in the sky, or, you know.
Sure. Hear the sounds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about at school? I mean, you did some sport at school. You mentioned there the inter-school and the swimming and the softball. What else was school like for you just in general?
Oh, I wasn't I was quite good at it, I suppose, again, just because quite naturally there was there's intellect there. But I don't recall being a very curious student for a very long time. I didn't really become curious till I finished uni and started teaching. That part of my DNA kicked in. Here's an example. I did human movement at uni, and I was a social student. To be perfectly honest, I wasn't a student. I just did enough to get by, but I was at uni to socialise, basically. And, you know, when you're talking about 9,000 people in a uni, that's a lot of socialising. And then my first teaching appointment was at Katanning Senior High School in the country, which I absolutely loved. But straight away, my analytical brain kicked in, and I realised that I wasn't well prepared for this. Even though I loved being around young people, which I've always enjoyed doing, I had no experience about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. And as you can imagine, in country, like a country town like Katanning, there was a lot of Aboriginal students. I knew I liked their company because I used to play with them when I was a kid in Boulder. But I didn't know anything about, I had no idea about racism, the fact that they weren't allowed to go to school when I was at primary school in Boulder. I didn't know that till I was quite a deal older. And all the stolen generation stuff, everything that they had to put up with. So I had no understanding about their lives and how their culture played out for them. Mm. And I had no clues about Christmas Islanders either. And at Katanning, the abattoirs had a huge Christmas Island population. So in my first year of teaching, I was introduced to Ramadan. And it's like, you're joking. It's
sure.
Like 38 degrees and you're not even drinking water because of your religious understanding. So because I'm also a bit opinionated, I thought, right, well, I'm going to write to my lecturers and say, you haven't actually prepared me well enough for my, if I'm going to be the best teacher that these kids have, I don't feel well prepared at all. So any chance in the future you could do something around Aboriginals and other cultures? And bless them, I remember writing to Rod Raitt, was his name, and months later he sent me a draft of a module around teaching Aboriginal students. I went,
stop
it. My God, yeah. Mind you, at the time I sort of thought maybe mine was a little bit of the impetus, but I actually realise now that they were thinking about it already. How good of them, though, back in the day to go, what do you reckon about what we've got planned here? And for me, I was going, oh, my God, if I'd known this, I'd have been so much better to start my teaching career. So I just learned on the go, really.
So you consulted, you provided that feedback for, like, essentially the first UWA School of Education curriculum for that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been doing that my entire career about everything.
Putting your two cents in.
Well, I don't like to just whinge. And I got that from Dad in particular. He used to say, well, he still does, if you feel it's the right thing to do, go through with it. You know, give the evidence and then give some options around what might happen if you, you know, fix up this situation. Here's some options. So basically I've been doing that in every job I've ever done. And it's one of the reasons I ended up the AFL National Manager of Female Football Development, because I was working part-time with the WA Football Commission at the time. And the first National Women's Carnival that I went to was nowhere near the standard and professionalism I was expecting, having been brought up with the male football side of things and seeing what happens on their talent pathway and everything. And also having played state in two sports, cricket and volleyball, the national carnivals I'd been to for both of them were far more higher in standard than
sure.
the football one that I went to. But the skill level of the athletes running around and the bravery was just as good as anything I'd ever seen before in my life. It was just the organisation and, you know, what happened was some teams would have an esky in the grandstand for after the game. It's like, you don't go drinking alcohol if you're on the highest level stage for your code currently. You don't get drunk afterwards or drink lots of alcohol. That's not recovery. And I saw lots of other things as well. So again, I wrote an email to the AFL and I, you know, outlined all the things that I thought could be done better and some possible solutions to this. And so they came back and said, would you like to be one day a week as the AFL's National Manager of Female Football Development? And I went, yep. So I did that for a year alongside 4 days with the WA Footy Commission. And of course, they realised within that one day, that's not enough, so we'll make you full-time. And I was allowed to be Perth-based too, which was pretty incredible. You know, them having a flexible workplace, having someone Perth-based and yet their head office is Melbourne.
Sure.
So good on them for being so innovative.
Good on them for being innovative, but I love that it's not even a matter of you sort of taking up space or reclaiming space. You just made the space for yourself in the role that you have there.
Yeah. And it wasn't about me. It was about the women getting a much better opportunity to really showcase their skills and actually elevate their skills, and the umpires and the administrators, because they're all there at this national carnival.
It's interesting as well that you were able to, almost from the outside, notice that was happening as both a player but also like an organisational standpoint as well, and seeing from both of those experiences how you're able to contribute to that. Let's talk a little bit about some of your professional sporting endeavours, because we've talked a lot about some of the earlier life stuff, but tell me about how you got into the volleyball and the cricket.
Oh, well, the cricket, I was just walking past the nets, basically. You know how it is. And because I'd played backyard cricket with my brothers and their friends, it didn't seem like a weird thing to do. I knew that I could actually bowl the ball not too bad, because you had to, otherwise you'd get hit over the fence for six, which was a good thing because it used to be six and out in backyard cricket. And I thought, I quite like playing backyard cricket. I wonder what the real deal would be like. And so I actually went over. I had a bit of time from whatever I was doing next and said, oh, look, I don't suppose I can have a bowl. And then the rest is history. I played for quite a few years for UWA. We were reasonably successful, made a few grand finals, met a great group of girls to play with, made state a few times. When I went teaching at Katanning, actually, I was still a state cricketer. And so to keep up my skills, because they said, yeah, if you come up, that was way too hard back in the day because they weren't flexible enough, you know, because I couldn't get to any trainings. I dropped down the bowling order. I was already down the bottom for the batting, so that didn't make any difference. But but I was an opening bowler at the time, and then I became like third or fourth. And then the ball's not as new and shiny, so you can't bowl it as fast and swing it as much. I learnt very quickly that, no, there's no flexibility here. I'll give it up. But meanwhile, to practice, I was bowling to a fellow who was in the country 11 for the men. And, yeah, he tonked me around a fair bit, but he was a really fine batter. But a few times I managed to get through his defence and stuff. and a B-grade men's team, Woodanilling, who had a few teachers and farmers and that, said, do you want to play for us? And I went, oh, that'd be good. And I played one season and I quite enjoyed it, but I also felt a little bit like beetroot on a white sheet. You know, I was the only woman in the whole league. I was way down the bowling list because I just wasn't competitive enough for the male batters, and I hardly ever got a bat because they never went down the list. They were quite strong, Woodanilling.
That's an interesting picture that you paint about regional country Western Australia, being a teacher in a school that's full of these children that you weren't actually necessarily equipped to teach, and now you're playing in the men's cricket team.
How innovative was Woodanilling, eh?
Mm.
Back in the day. So that would have been late 70s, and I never heard one misogynistic comment, not within earshot of me. There was no sexual harassment. There was nothing from them or the opposition.
That's fantastic.
I know, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And it's amazing when you think that was in the late 70s and really unique. And yet, fast forward to the 2000s when we're living in another country town. And by this stage, I've had enormous experience at a waffle premiership team, Swan Districts, as their assistant head trainer. I get to this country town and my son's playing D grade as a 10-year-old. And the club says, oh, would anyone like to be the trainer for the D grade? And I went, oh, yeah, I'll redo my accreditation. This is my experience. And I was told by one of the men in the club, this grass is just for the men.
And he was 10 years old, your son?
My son was 10 years old. So this is in the 2000s versus Woodanilling, who didn't blink an eyelid to invite me to play cricket for their team. So not even cut the oranges, be a trainer, actually play, versus in the 2000s, you're not even going to be a trainer for our D-grade team, which is basically 12 and under boys.
Is it the first time you encountered any comments like that?
Not really. There was lots over the years, basically. I remember doing my level one accreditation for AFL four times, and not once was I given opportunity to coach Auskick even at that level, because I actually thought I was quite a good teacher, and so I felt that I didn't have to necessarily know heaps of stuff about how to play the game or whether I could do the skills that well, as long as I could convey to the kids that I was coaching. And so it was only when my husband was coaching our sons in Auskick that he went, oh, I know you've always wanted to do this, why don't you take the warm up while I'm setting up all the skill drills or whatever. So I loved it.
That's disappointing to hear, though, that that's something that happened. I mean, look, the early 2000s is not like it was yesterday, but it certainly wasn't 30 years ago either.
Exactly. So it's a bit bizarre that Woodanilling, this smaller country town, you know, that I think had a schoolhouse, a pub, and drew on a farming community, basically, was so far ahead of their time compared to a bigger country town 30-odd years later.
But anyway, sure.
I don't like to look in the rearview mirror, so.
Of course. I'm sorry, I'm going to make you do that a lot
That's
today.
That's all right, Taylor.
You start in Katanning and you are invited to the men's team. Years go by and you've done the cricket thing, you've done the volleyball thing. Where do you find yourself post-teaching?
Well, volleyball was kind of really post-teaching, to be honest, because I'd come back to the city from bits and pieces and my friends were playing volleyball and they were really enjoying it. So I thought, well, I'll see if I can take that up. And I didn't do that for very long, only because basically my age, and just when I'd cracked the state team, the following year I decided to do a teaching exchange to Canada, thinking in my head selfishly, you know that they're better volleyballers in Australia. Maybe I would be able to play a good league over there. But their sport setup is quite different. Where ours is run by volunteers in community, theirs you can only play if you're at school. Hmm. So secondary school, elementary or university. And I wasn't going to pay thousands of dollars to register in a course at their uni just to play volleyball. So I just went down to the local uni and watched various carnivals that came on, and yeah, it was a really great standard. I would have loved to have played in it. And that was it. When I came back from teaching exchange, I thought, no, my body's done really with all that weight bearing. I'll just do my own thing.
Back in the pool.
Or go back to netball.
I have to ask what your position in netball is, because there's these schools of thought that your position dictates your personality. I don't buy into any of it.
Centre.
Okay. I'm a WA, so I actually don't know what that means.
That means that have good quick reflexes and you are powerful off the go.
Yeah, all right.
When the whistle goes, you're...
And what do they say about centres?
Good tank.
Okay, yeah, good. Do you feel like that's true?
Person. Yeah, yeah. But as I got older, like even at Katanning, there was a former Australian centre playing in Katanning as a mature-aged woman. She was still awesome. I can't remember her name. And so she used to do the country week. That was the big thing to get in the country week team. So she used to always be the centre and she also coached the team. But she also saw, right, well, you've got speed, you're a bit feisty, blah, blah, blah. So we'll put you in goal attack. I also had quite a good jump, but we had the most awesome goal shooter who just hardly ever missed, this wonderful Aboriginal woman. So the coach said to me, your job is to feed Rhonda, I do remember her name, and get any rebounds should she miss or whatever. And I thought, well, you know, I will have to practice goal shooting because I've never done that before. So after my school day, I'd spend time doing 100 shots at goal, where you'd sort of throw the ball to yourself, catch it, take a shot, get the rebound, or go again with another shot. So I was quite dedicated to it. Between Rhonda and I and the rest of the team, we ended up winning our country week grade a couple of times, actually. So
that's great.
Yeah. So I was quite grateful because it was a new challenge for me in a sport that I'd been involved in since I was a small child.
Tell me a little bit about what is the thing that drives you to continue playing sport at that point? Because that's social sport then, yeah? You're not being paid to be on the court for that.
It's sort of the love of movement, really. And I guess now I have an understanding of myself. Something I really like doing is being on the bus with a bunch of other people and trying to achieve something. So whether it's as a member of a sporting team to try and go as far as you can in a season, or, you know, win the grand final or whatever, I think it's just that doing the connection thing with lots of others.
And something that you've obviously pursued throughout your career is engaging with both men and women in professional sporting sort of situations. What's it like working alongside maybe strictly women or playing in teams of women in sport? What is the significance of those female sort of interactions?
Oh, a lot of it's the friendship first and foremost. But when you're talking about like a representative team, you might not necessarily be playing with your friends. You're playing with the opposition that you play against on a weekly basis. So again, I think it's just part of how you bond and the enjoyment you have socially. But then you go, okay, well, when we're on the court, this is how we're going to go about it together. And there can't be any weak links. You know, everybody has to be on the same page to get the best out of themselves, especially a small-sided team like netball and volleyball, where, you know, you have to rely on every position to do the best that they can be.
This is RTRFM's Herstory. I'm Taylor Strano, and we're here with Australian Rules football trailblazer and WA Women's Hall of Fame 2017 inductee, Jan Cooper. It's time to talk AFL. It's the thing that I think most people, when they hear Jan Cooper, they go, oh, yes, footy, of course, duh. Explain to us how this entire career started for you. When did you step foot into a position in the AFL?
It would have been 2006, because my husband was working in football for about 18 years, and people he used to work with understood that I was quite passionate about football because they met me, obviously. We moved to the country. I'm in a small primary school. The school is doing some really good things, cross-curricular around AFL, bringing Aboriginal boys back into the classroom after recess, which they weren't really that thrilled about coming back to the classroom, et cetera, et cetera. So we moved back to the city, And two of the administrators of the day, Colin West and Grant Dorrington, meet with me and say, we'd like you to do some of your cross-curricular stuff with our AFL school ambassadors. And by the way, would you be interested in growing the female football pathway? Because both of them could see that it was time to open up the code to the other gender. And the rest is history. I was actually working part-time in a primary school and part-time at the WA Football Commission. And Colin West was my manager. And the other people that were in the department at the time, they were easy to advocate to because they understood that, that this was the right thing to do. So I didn't have to try very hard to advocate to them at all. They were brilliant. You know, here's an example. Darren Davis, the school's manager, when I was going through trying to get my head around what was happening at school level and what were the opportunities there, I realised that if you were in a male team at school level, you didn't pay a registration for your team. But if you were a female, you paid a registration for your team. And it seems bleeding obvious to me when I'm reading it. And I just said to him, why are the girls paying and the boys aren't? And he goes, no reason, don't know. I'll fix it. Yep. So he talked to School Sport WA and it was like, oh, yeah, no one's kind of ever said that before. So, you know, that analytical brain again. So, yep, he went off and he fixed all that with School Sport WA and they were terrific. And so it went on. It was like, do an audit of the industry, first and foremost. Get your evidence about why do girls want to play this game? Why do they want to umpire? Why do they want to coach? And then use that evidence to start opening the doors for opportunities for them. So I was really blessed that I already had a football network because of my husband and my father being involved, so I could go quite confidently to many people. And also, too, it helped that Colin West and I had gone to high school together, so we had a mutual respect for each other before this. And they were really helpful in helping me when I got to AFL level to make things happen as well.
What was that transition like? How did you step foot into the National League?
It was a bit difficult at first. I had a fantastic upline, Dean Warren and David Matthews, and David is now the CEO of the Giants, so he understands being the CEO of the Giants, you know, the integration piece around females and stuff. Both of them were very supportive and tried really hard to advocate in their roles what needed to be done. I was really lucky there. And I was also more lucky too, I think, having Dean as my immediate upline in the first instance, because I was only one day a week. He was still living in Brisbane. I was living in Perth. That was serendipitous, because I think if he'd been Melbourne-based initially, there might not have been the same connection, but we both understood what it meant to be not living in Melbourne and how we had to support each other subconsciously more so to get the message across. He did then shift to Melbourne and was able to enact a few other things. It was basically having good men in my upline initially to help out.
It's that funny thing of sometimes in Melbourne, people feel like Melbourne is the actual centre of the universe.
Correct.
And especially when it comes to the National Football League,
yep.
Totally get that. But when you realise there are people on opposite ends of the country who are still trying to advocate for the exact same thing, that in itself is kind of like an advantage.
Yeah, it was. It also helped that most of the men who were fantastic were also had daughters. And so quite often with naysayers, you could say, but this is the right thing to do. Don't you want the same world for your daughters as you want for your son or your sons? Why are we even having this discussion? You know, just get on with it. So,
was it always like apparent to you, and I don't know how you sort of identify yourself, Jan, but was it always apparent to you that like it was an issue of feminism in professional sport?
Oh, some of it was for sure, Taylor. And then some of it was, you know, like there was a line that came out often with some of the naysayers. Because remember here that 99.9% of the decision makers in the code, it didn't matter what level within the code, were men. You'd be the only woman in a meeting and they'd say, oh, yeah, but if the girls play this game, aren't they going to lose their femininity, for example? And it's like, what do you mean by femininity? Because this is my version of it. And it's being empowered and confident and content and challenging themselves no matter what the opportunity is. They just want to challenge themselves and be included. And, like, I don't get why you wouldn't mirror your community, because the community is not all white men. or white middle-aged men, as most of the decision makers were at the time. That was, you know, a conversation that we had to roll out a lot. And then if you were in the LGBTQI plus community, or an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, or another, another culture, it was doubly worse for you, because then there was comments like, once when I first asked, could I go to the Nationals, because I'm the female manager for the commission, and one of the senior execs said, oh, that's just a carnival beer swilling dykes. And it's not just obviously disrespectful, but what do you mean by that? You know, like,
it's a total lack of understanding of what's even going on.
Correct. Have you ever seen them? And, you know, and that was all these disparaging comments were all cues for me to go, okay, if you say that, what am I going to be doing in response to that? You know, what's my response going to be? So I had to work out a whole lot of conversation lines, but even more importantly, I had to have strategies. So quite often if they'd go, beer swilling dykes, well, let's bring you to a game and let me show you the bravery and the passion these women have for the code, and then maybe it will open your heart and your eyes to what the possibilities are for the code or your club or the league that you're a decision maker of.
Comments like that bleed deeper than just a lack of understanding of how sport works. That becomes far more of a cultural thing.
Absolutely. And there was so much of that. When I've been asked this question before around what were some of the barriers, for example, I actually do it in three chunks. I look at it as being societal, which is that feminine, you know, sexuality thing. The media had a huge role to play in that, how they portrayed or didn't even discuss female athletes in any shape or form. Then the organisation. So the biases there are things that, again, every decision maker was usually a white man. And culturally, there was things like, well, we can't give resources to the women because that will take it away from the men, instead of looking at it as a business model and going, actually, hello, if you get more people into the code, you're going to get more money into the code, because that will relate to memberships, more money over the bar, blah, blah, blah. You know, the whole box and dice just goes up. Merch.
Sure.
Everything.
As someone who's operated from both the inside and the outside, Jen, what is that fear? Like, where does that come from, the fear of giving women the space and the time?
I actually don't know. There are a certain percentage, and I don't want to say how many because I've got no evidence for it, but just anecdotally, I think there's a certain percentage actually afraid that we might be better at something than they are. You know, there's that little power thing. But then some of the power comes back to dollars and cents. So it's not just around being a leader or a decision maker. It comes down to business. And the number of times I would sit at functions and go, oh my God, I cannot believe it. I used to say it was they believe they're legends in their own lunchbox. And I'd be sitting there just steaming with anger that they would just not even ask me questions, not be the least bit interested in who I was as a person, let alone what I could bring to the code, completely exclude me from any conversations. And so I had to get my bravery shoes on and go, I know the game you're talking about, because I'm an AFL tragic. I've looked at hundreds and thousands of games on the winners on the ABC every Sunday night with the family. We talk ad nauseum about football. I've watched thousands of games. You know, like, people would look at me and go, oh, that poor tragic woman, but too bad, I love it. So I knew who they were talking about, and I knew some of them were the people that everyone was talking about because they were former players or whatever. And all of a sudden I got a little bit of validation because I could actually say, oh yeah, I remember that, or I remember when you did this or that. And they were going, really? And I go, I'm not alone with this. There are hundreds of thousands of other women that would be able to hold this same conversation with you because they love the game as well. Like, apart from bracketing, get it through your thick skulls that we love the code too. And then some of the time, the third grouping was basically women themselves. Women who had so many skills to offer, but just didn't have the confidence to put themselves forward and would quite often just put their hands up for the kiosk or put their, you know, hand up for doing the Florence Nightingale bit as a trainer or whatever and not go, you know what, actually I could be the president of the club.
Mm.
And there's been some brave souls over the day, which includes this week's grand final. Don't know if you know, Taylor, but both teams have a female president.
That must be one of the first times in AFL history that's happened.
Yeah, and I'm so pleased because I'm over the first time for everything. But thank you to both those presidents. And now we can lock that one away as, you know.
Yep. Completely.
First and last time. That, you know.
Well, this episode of the podcast is airing sort of just before the AFL grand final airs a few days early.
Significant.
So, you know, the fact that you're also here is significant. Like you said, you don't want it to be the first of the first. The first Perth, it's the first whatever.
Yeah, but we'll take it until, you know,
totally.
It's all behind us.
It would be remiss not to.
And there's another first. It means that, back-to-back premierships will be led by a female because Peggy O'Neill is the Richmond president and they were last year's premiers. So,
and nobody,
go girls!
Nobody spontaneously combusted. Everything was
funny about that. And I love that. It's also Melbourne and Western Bulldogs because they were the first two AFL clubs to embrace the exhibition games concept. And from the exhibition games concept grew AFLW. And there was two clubs that already knew how to integrate their women, what needed to be done.
Women are playing AFL, women are playing football all around the country prior to the announcement of the AFLW. Do you remember the day when the AFLW was officially signed off? What were you doing? How were you feeling?
I was bawling my head off. Gillon McLachlan actually announced it ahead of when we'd had our head wrapped around it. We'd taken our foot off the pedal a bit, to be honest, because we had the numbers that our vision said we would have. We were aiming for 250,000 to have the depth of talent to put on a national league, and we were thinking maybe six teams at the time. When Gillon announced it, it virtually meant 7 months from announcing to implementation. I mean, truly, it's not a long time. And I got given a text going, oh, look what Gillon's announced. And I'm going, what the hell? What's he thinking? 5 minutes I was in a spin. And then I went, oh, Gillon, you jet. You've done, of course, we've got 480,000 women and girls running around. We've surpassed our 250,000 target. Of course we're ready to go. Bring it on. I was sitting in Perth and he was sitting in Melbourne. And again, if I'd been Melbourne-based and been at that press conference, I probably would have, you know, tackled him to the ground and gone, what are you thinking?
Ugly cried on TV.
Yeah, correct. But then when they launched the first licences, oh, my God, I couldn't speak. I remember it was at the MCG and it was a beautiful sunny day and there was little girls dressed in all the jumpers and then, of course, there was key players that were going to head the teams that had been given the licences. And I remember just sitting up in the kind of ground level seats, just watching it all unfold and looking up at the big screen and just, I was speechless, absolutely speechless. So, yeah, it was amazing. And then every first after that has just been a wave of emotion, really.
It's like an actual pinch me moment when you're sitting there going, this is it.
I know.
We've done the thing.
Yeah, but it continues. You know, like then I'm sitting watching Adelaide play Carlton at Adelaide Oval. The second biggest crowd ever. I was sitting with Samantha Mostyn, and it would be remiss if we didn't talk about Samantha Mostyn Taylor, because she's been a big part of this journey. So if we could get on to her after this. But we were sitting on one side of the ground and we knew that the top tier opposite us wasn't going to be open, because we were only expecting maybe 25 to 35,000 in there. So that was surpassed very quickly. And then all of a sudden, we're both holding on to each other going, there's people coming into the top tier. And so she's doing something with somebody from the AFL going, oh, my God, there's 45,000 in the ground. Oh, my God, there's 50. Oh, my God, there's 53,000. And then it went up on the big screen and it was just like I remember the start of a grand final at the MCG, there was this huge roar, like everybody had watched the screen at the same time. And it's like, oh, my God, we've come of age. We're in a grand final of AFLW, and there's 53,000 people in the house watching, and 51,000 of them were barracking for the Crows. But who cares?
Before she left the field, the Adelaide Crows win us by 45 points in front of a record crowd, 53,034 here at the Adelaide
Oval. Here's another moment from that game. Erin Phillips, superstar, goes down with an ACL. And it doesn't really matter because the Crows are so far ahead at that point. But I have never seen anything like this in my life on a sporting arena. The man charged with the little four-wheel drive to stretch her off. You're meant to go grab the player, get to the nearest sideline, go around the ground so the game can continue. I don't know what went through his head, and I'm so pleased he did it. He went, I'm going to go down the guts. Erin Phillips gets put on the stretcher. He goes right down the guts, slow-mo. All the players come over and wish her well. The crowd, I'm crying in this stage because I'm sitting next to Sam Most and I'm going, oh, she's done an ACL. How can you tell? Well, because she held her knee and I just saw the replay on the screen. She's buckled, she's gone. All the players, umpires, you name it, he's gone slowly down the guts. The standing ovation for her was something like I've never seen in my life. And there's another first. Would that have happened if it had been an AFL game? No, he probably would have lost his job because he hasn't done what he's meant to do. But bloody good on him for doing that because it was a really special moment. Even though it was for a crap reason, the actual moment is obviously indelibly imprinted in my brain. So
sure. You mentioned there, Sam, and you're right. We need to speak about some of the other people who helped accomplish this. Do you want to tell us about some of those significant people?
I'd love to. So both men and women, as I've already alluded to, several of my bosses along the way have been fantastic advocates. But when you're talking about decision makers, even they are down the rung when it comes to really being embedded with, like, the AFL Commission, who are the keepers of the code, senior executive at AFL House. So you're not sure necessarily that they even have a voice at those levels. But one person who did was Samantha Mostyn. So she was the first AFL commissioner female. And the AFL didn't even tell me that she was on the commission. I found out from television.
Okay.
One night surfing, just going, oh, can't go to bed yet, bit wired, Q&A. And this very intelligent woman is, you know, providing some evidence.
Speaking
and
your
stuff.
Language.
Yeah, yeah. She's on Q&A talking about environmental stuff because she was on a board at the time or whatever. And I went, oh, my God, she's good. I'd love to get to know her. So I didn't even know at that point that she was an AFL commissioner until the end. And they said, oh, thank you to Samantha Mostyn, you know, first AFL female commissioner of the AFL. And I went, you're kidding me. So this is like 10:30 at night. Usually I'm in bed by then. So get in touch with AFL House the next day. Go, who is this Samantha Mostyn? Have to meet her. Why haven't you told me this before? Like, I'm the manager. She's in a decision-making role and I find out by accident, like truly. Anyway, park that one. I meet Sam, like-minded. We chat for hours. We continue to keep chatting for hours. She's brilliant. And I can send her anything, any evidence, anything that I'd like to have changed. And it's always based on the collaborative good of all the managers around the states and territories whose role was female footy development in their state and territories, and that was men and women. The then presidents of the State Women's League, who were all volunteers, she was our key voice at commission level, and she pushed lots of things that we needed to get through very hard. And she supported the managers when they were voicing things at senior execs. Without her in the first instance, a lot of things wouldn't have come to fruition.
Is that what success looks like then? Somebody like Sam?
Oh, yeah. When you look at who was on the visionary bus at the time, there was a big cohort, and that's what I think made the difference. It was like throwing a boulder in a bird bath. The ripple effect was huge. If we just kept beavering away, not as a collective, like if Victoria had just kept beavering away as Victoria, yeah, some things would have happened, but not as quickly. You know, Northern Territory's been very successful in their female development pathway. Tassie, everybody has been successful in what they've had to do. And because there were so many of us employed, and then we got a good circle of influence around the Samantha Mostyns of the world in each state and territory as well as nationally, you know, we picked off key decision makers who understood it was the right thing to do, and it just went from there. So it was basically about putting as many people on the bus as we could who shared the same vision as us. And it was interesting because we could sense that there was huge competition at men's level between, for example, South Australia and WA don't particularly like the Victorians necessarily. We did. We loved the female managers at South Australia and Victoria, for example. All of the managers were on board with the same vision. The only time we got competitive with each other was when there was actual national competitions happening, and we kind of, yeah, weren't as collaborative then. But in terms of putting on the best possible game or the best standard, the best umpires, attracting the best coaches to coach your state team, we were all on the same page. You know, if you look at AFLW games, there's still that respect for each other. There's not really that intense kind of white line fever yet. And I, in a way, I'd kind of be surprised if it ever got as hard-nosed as the men, just because I think we're wired differently. They want to beat each other, but it's not dog-eat-dog type style.
It's not reported on like that yet, so hopefully it stays that way as well.
Yeah, I'd like to think so, because I think that's part of the unique quality of AFLW.
It's been very busy for you. I want to say like in the last 5 to 10 years, but I feel like you've been busy for a very long time, Jan. I want to change pace slightly. Yeah. And with everything that's been going on, you know, the last 18 months, the world kind of shut down. Most families haven't seen each other. People have been delaying whatever, whatever. But how are you doing? How are you?
Oh, see, football saved my life a bit too, to be honest. Because I've had breast cancer, and part of my set of angels have been through football. So the football connection has been extraordinary. Both my sons play for West Coast Amateurs. They did a big shave, raised $32,000, had about 18 young men shave, had a couple over in the East Coast, which included a lovely young female that... We've both been colleagues over the journey, but she now lives in Melbourne, so she shaved, and so it went on. West Coast Eagles have been astonishing, been quite flexible with my work situation so that I can, you know, go to medical appointments, and just the kindness and compassion of the staff that I work with has been extraordinary. Just incredible things, like some of the women, the originals in these national academies that were set up, you know, like Daisy Pearce, Chelsea Randall, Steph Kiocchi, Aster O'Connor, Lauren Arnell, Premiership AFLW player. Like, all these women made a video of, come on, Coops, you've inspired us, so get on with it, you know, and we're thinking of you and we're loving you. And there were so many messages from the football community. It was actually quite overwhelming, but also quite humbling to think that I had this big army of angels just pushing and prodding me into a better space.
Really, like, speaks to the importance of having that community then, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And how are you feeling now?
Oh, good. Yeah, hair's growing back.
Good.
Getting stronger. Yeah, so I'm feeling really good.
Excellent.
Thank you.
You're sitting across from me in some very bright blue and gold.
It's work day.
It's a work day. From literally your earrings all the way down, you are Eagles representing. Where are you at now? What's sort of your role at the West Coast Eagles?
Yeah. So I'm the AFLW wellbeing manager, which basically entails ensuring that the players are the best version of themselves. So that in encapsulates supporting them mentally with whatever's happening in their lives, providing education pieces to them, looking at menstrual phases and how they can get the best out of themselves when they're in menstrual phases that aren't too flash for an elite athlete. Things like sleep education, all sorts of strategies to help them really thrive, because our mantra is we would like them to leave a better version of themselves, if that's possible, and we'll do everything to facilitate that. It's up to them, of course, but we'll provide as much support as we can to help.
How important is that off the field and not so necessarily skills or training focused in that sort of realm in what you're doing now? What's the significance of providing that to professional athletes and to professional female athletes?
Oh, it's hugely important, providing that wellbeing program, simply because they have such a busy life. Most of them are pursuing their off-grass career or studying to do so, and then they come to training. So they have whatever their career hours are and study hours, and then they have football. We're trying to help them to balance up being at home, being with family and friends, having self-care, which is so important. And you realise that pre-season and in-season, it's just full on for them. So that's why it's absolutely crucial to support them the way we do. But also too, I've worked out over the years that it's all very well doing the body and the craft when you're an elite athlete and supporting them that way, but the missing piece to the puzzle is what's between the ears. More so now with social media and the extra scrutiny and, you know, those keyboard cowards who like to just throw out disparaging and disrespectful comments without even having lived in the shoes of any of these athletes. The mind is so important. So we do a huge mindfulness program as well to help them be more present and clear a space and give them some calm time to really just be still, and then, you know, give themselves a bit of a refreshment to go on to the next part of their busy lives.
It's very obvious some of the reasons that you do what you do and have done what you have done for your entire career, Jan, but is one of the hopes that when the next crop come through and the next crop come through, that it just gets that little bit easier?
Yeah, I would like to think so, but it doesn't surprise me if it's not the case. What I've also learnt too as a parent, I was saying to my sons about a month ago, God, if I knew now, or back then what I know now, I would have been such a better parent, because I've learnt so many extra skills and understandings to be a better parent, because no one actually really teaches you how to parent, which of course is the most important role you could have in life, I believe, now that I've been one. And so I felt like I'd let them down to a certain extent. Thankfully, they disagreed with me, but I still do believe that I've got so much more that I can share with them to allow them to be better people. And certainly if they become parents and they seek advice, I'll be explaining to them some things that I've learnt along the way.
Before we let you go, Jan, we do have to talk about your achievements and your awards and all the lovely things that have been said about you and awarded to you. One of those, which I think is one of the most impressive things, is about how many people, and I want to get the numbers right, many people have credited your leadership for the increase in national female participation in football from 16,000 to over 640,000 women.
It's probably more like 500,000. It could be okay. At 640,000 now, but when I left the AFL, it was around about 500,000. So I'll get that part right for you.
That's huge.
That's still huge, yes. Well, there was not much there, though. And again, it was quite serendipitous. You know, for me to write that email, for the men to read it and go, all right, well, you can be the national manager, and then, you know, doing that one day a week for a year and then it growing very quickly to full-time because they understood there was more potential if you were full-time. But everybody else that had to help with that, I couldn't have done it without the Samantha Mostyns of the world and each of the states and territories who had dedicated female football development managers who were outstanding people and really good at their job. And I'm still good mates with heaps of them, even though we're wide flung. You know, one's the American women's cricket coach, for example, Julia Price, who was at AFL Queensland back in the day. Just outstanding administrators, passionate, dedicated, and they had to put up with a lot too. you know, when you're talking of misogyny and everything else that's been discussed today, they had to put up with that. And the ones who are lesbian had double the stuff to put up with because they were held at arm's length for a very long time before momentum could be built. I was just lucky in a way that when I wrote that email, they paid attention, gave me an opportunity, and, yeah, I took it with both hands.
Some of the other awards include the 2015 Football Woman of the Year. They also include the WA Women's Hall of Fame, which I want to talk about in a moment. Finalist at the Western Australian of the Year Sport and United Nations Diversity and Inclusion, and so on and so forth. The WA Women's Hall of Fame, an inductee in 2017. What was it like getting that call or email and saying, hey, we want to pop you in on this list of women?
Well, I felt a bit embarrassed, to be honest, Taylor. My first response was that because I went, oh, what's this? I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know who nominated me. So I went on their website and went, oh, my God, look at all these people and their CVs. Like, ugh, I'm not sure that I'm deserving of this. That was the first thought. And then something, I suppose, I thought, well, no, why shouldn't I? Because in a lot of ways is kind of groundbreaking. And it's one of the things that I have a crack at a lot of females about is not celebrating when they're given these accolades. And I thought, well, no, you have to just, you have to celebrate it. Be that role model to, you can't say to the girls on one hand, you need to celebrate this. This is outstanding. And then go, oh, no, thanks very much. Or hide. I felt very humbled when I read the other CVs, but I'm comfortable with it now. And I think it's a great award because it does show and recognise and celebrate achievements that otherwise wouldn't be known to the general public. And to be frank, I didn't, when we had that early discussion, I didn't really have female role models. You know, I virtually had my mum for a long time because there was no public portrayal of fabulous female role models.
Definitely not in professional sport necessarily either.
No.
Your mum could run fast, so she was all right. You were off to a good start.
Yeah.
With female role models.
And she was brave. She picked herself up and went off again. And I actually think hockey, she was a hockey player. That's an awesome and skillful game. And having that bloody hard ball, you know, zinging around at head height, it's like, whoa, you people are seriously courageous. So
pop the mouth guard in for
that
one. Yeah,
that's about it.
I like that you're not shy about that, Jan. I mean, you weren't shy when you sent the email. You weren't shy when you were advocating fearlessly for women and taking on maybe the UWA School of Education curriculum. So it doesn't make sense that you wouldn't, you know, accept this award with wide open arms either. You've sort of alluded to it a little bit there, but I want to end by talking a little bit about the podcast that we have. And this podcast is called Herstory, which is a play on history.
Love it.
Do you have any thoughts or feelings about the word herstory? Is that something that you've encountered before?
Yeah, I have, but only a few times. And I love it because, you know, men listening to this might think, oh, there's a bit of male bashing going on here. And it's actually not. You know, because they weren't the ones that developed the English language. That's a historical thing. But let's face it, so much of the English language actually celebrates blokes, you know. And history might be one of those accidental words that was never meant to celebrate, but it's got, it starts with the word his. So why wouldn't you say her story as part of it rather than his? And there's a few other words and I can't remember what they are. Oh, yes, I can. In our game, it's ruckman. So let's just call us all ruck. Man up.
Mm.
Just get your player.
Yeah.
You know, we need to drop some of the language so it actually does sound a little bit more inclusive and that you dink them about inclusivity because you are aware that some of the language isn't inviting. Another one is welfare. When I first got to the club, I think I was the welfare manager, and our advisory group, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Advisory Group, said to us, can you change that to wellbeing? Because welfare has a negative connotation for our culture.
Sure.
Not an issue. Wellbeing it is. And so now we voice when people use that word, welfare, and say it's actually not that respectful, or it makes Aboriginal
it like
people feel uncomfortable, so let's drop that.
It makes it feel like it's dire straits as well.
Yeah, it does. It does.
And
yeah.
It's not.
No. So back to her story, I think that's exceptional, and And I think this is great that you're publicly putting out there the fabulous stories so that the generation behind us can see what is available to them and what they can achieve. And even some, you know, in the stories, there'll be some tips on how they can achieve it if they haven't thought about it.
Mm.
I think it's a brilliant idea.
I love that. Thank you. I think we're learning. I mean, like yourself, Jen, I didn't know we had a WA Women's Hall of Fame. And then I looked at it and I was like, well, yeah, these people are good.
Yeah.
These women are great.
Outstanding. And well, there's so many, a diversity of fields. That's what's so great about it. That's
completely.
What I think's brilliant for young women looking, going, oh, my God, I can be whatever I want to be. And here's some ideas about how to get along this pathway based on these women, what they've done. And over here, if I want to do that in the arts, I can. Yeah, it's an excellent idea.
We're a radio station, so we have to play music. Do you have any favourite songs or artists? Or I'm not going to play the West Coast theme song. I'm just telling you right now.
Can I tell you, I love my music. So I can't really zero in on one. But stupidly or maudlingly, in a way, I have got a playlist if I should pass away. And sort of cliched, yeah, Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin, because they were one of my favourites growing up. But just recently I've fallen across a cover version of Smoke on the Water by a crew called Two Way, which mm-hmm. is the number two, W-E-I. And the other day in mindfulness, I started with a beautiful, serene piece and then went this thumping, epic anthem, instrumental from Two Way. And one of the girls woke up and was going, what's Coops doing here? And it was deliberate because wrong response. If you're practicing mindfulness and you get this crazy thing happening externally to you, you need to practice your response, which is staying present, going back to your breath or going back to your game cue. If this should happen in the middle of a game and you respond like, what the... That's the wrong response. We can't have you doing that on the oval. So next time, how will you respond? It's like, yeah. Two of the girls, on the other hand, went, Coops, when you played that, we just felt we were superheroes. And went, correct response.
2 points.
Yeah, so if you're playing a tune currently that I'm really into, it would be Smoke on the Water cover version by Two Way.
All right, that's the best example and explanation I think we're going to get this whole series. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Jan Cooper and the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to all the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Janae Gibson. Assistant producers Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale. Our theme music is by Annika Moses and artwork by Peter Roebuck. Zoe Zarzicki also helped to edit this episode. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 2.